The subject for the talk tonight is, I promise to not talk more than an hour. Maybe.
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 Actually, something a little different maybe here. Does anybody have anything kind of burning? I mean that in the most sort of positive sense of burning, that they'd like to see in the talk. Could be a single word even, or a question. It's just burning. Please.
Guilt bubbled up for me, and then I felt so much better.
Yeah. Guilt bubbled up for me, and then I felt so much better.
Unfolding. What to do about flooding?
Flooding? Not to be cheeky, but ask the flood. So let's just say I start to talk, and then something bubbles up that just really needs to come out. Let it come out. I mean, try not to interrupt me. Because you won't. But you might think you did. I mean, just don't put the word on top of the word, that's all. I used to actually, in these kind of settings, particularly, I don't know, some kind of strange, romantic, idolized reverence. It maybe came out of this place of like being indoctrinated when first learning serious, what I thought of as serious meditation. There was a lot of rules, and one of the rules was, don't point your feet at the teacher. So it's this kind of Eastern Indian kind of thing. And as soon as that rule was presented, it was written in the little thing that we looked at when we came, and then it was presented again by the managers. Every part of me wanted to just go like this. Not both feet, just like stick it out, not let the managers see me, because there was a lot of managers in those days. Not both feet, that's too much, and then pull it back. Just... Isn't it true, though? Rules are made to be broken. So just play with that. Play with that sense. It's not just me talking. Yeah?
What about planning for compassionate activities?
That gets into planning in general. But if you're going to plan, might as well plan for compassionate activities. Yeah, keep it going. I'm going to talk a little bit. Keep it going. So, I spent 25 years, first 25 years of my life in New England and Massachusetts for the most part. Had heard just a little bit, but didn't really know much about Thoreau. It turns out Walden Pond was just... not very far, maybe 15 miles from where I lived. I went there once. Didn't do much for me. But when things touch, they touch, and when they don't, they don't. You know, some people go to some big kind of special pilgrimage site, and it doesn't work out for him. Nothing much happens. Because we're not in control. Yeah?
Things surrounding the word paradox.
Oh, yeah. You're going to do that one for sure. Absolutely. So I promise to try to not talk for more than an hour. Maybe.
Time.
Yeah, that part of the talk is over. I just addressed that.
You may be sorry you opened this up.
Not at all. Not at all. You may be sorry. Thoreau, he said a lot of interesting things, but here's something that he wrote down, and I guess he somewhat lived by. Beautiful, to me at least. He said, every human is tasked to make their life, even in its smallest details, worthy of the contemplation of their most elevated and critical hour. That's pretty good, huh? We pulled that in there like that? He's saying, to me at least, what's happening all the time is your most critical hour. It's your most critical moment. It's your contemplation. So every instant, life is instantaneous, isn't it? This is instantaneousness. Every instant is our critical hour. The most critical incident is this, and this, and this. So with that koan that Steve was offering, what is this? Perhaps a response. This is the most critical, important incident. This is it. So what some people call the sacred nature of life expresses itself as this precious, transitory flux and flow. It's unstoppable. At the same time that it's unstoppable, this constant, ephemeral, transitory, so-called dream, it's providing everything. Everything that the human, you could say, needs to awaken to the truth that doesn't change. The truth that doesn't change is always most simple. It cannot be reduced any further. No further simplification. Even just in these hours of sitting, or just in your life in general, you may have noticed that at times you're living by what you call perhaps life themes. You have themes that you've generated for your life. We talked about some of these in the small groups a bit. Pursuits. Inside these life themes are pursuits, often unexamined. The mind can be holding and continuing to generate reflexively basic assumptions about life. And what we got another term here. We talked a lot about beliefs last night. Belief and assumption, I like to say they've got to be two different things. That's why there's two different words. So right now, just look, what's the difference between belief and assumption? One possibility. Beliefs generate, they project into situations, relationships, assumptions. See if that makes sense. Underneath the assumptions that might be made about life, about yourself, about this, about that, are beliefs. So in a way, you're acting out your beliefs, potentially, through the assumptions. You know what these are for you. What are you pursuing? What is life about for you? What are you going for? And why? What do you expect to get? Let's back up. There are currents of thought. We're seeing them to some extent, I would imagine, as we're sitting. Currents of thought and belief that are actually inherited. Inherited tendencies in thinking. Things we picked up along the way. We started coming into us in this form when we were too young to realize they were even coming into us. Other beings, say our parents, or who those who were around us or caring for us when we were small, they picked up inherited tendencies. They picked up beliefs and assumptions. And helplessly, maybe even with great care and kindness and interest, acted those out upon us, spoke those to us. And you could walk that one back, couldn't you? Walk back in and do the family tree. I remember doing this in graduate school. It blew my mind. It just absolutely like turned it around and inside out and upside down to just start to see these connections. And we had a whole process that I'm not going to go into that we did around that. You know, first you had to kind of do your layout and get the characters in place. And then we did a whole process of work around that, of opening that up and understanding those connections. It was really interesting. Pretty disturbing, too, in my case. It's like, oh my goodness. Got a little scary, like, whoa. That's powerful. That's a force. Grandpa? Swenson? Was like that? Maybe? That was the family name before Lynn got inserted. Sometimes people try to change themselves by changing their name. You know what one of the worst name changes you can come out with? Is the one some guru gives you. Catch that? That was precious. There's a story in there. I'm not going to ask Steve to say it. I had like three of them. I had them all going at the same time. One of them was Shanti. You know what that means? Peace. I couldn't decide which one to pick. There's some characters love them. I love them. They'll give you a name whether you want it or not. You come to their event, you get a name. Very few that I've ever seen step up and say, "What's the matter with the one I got? What's the matter with Paul?"
Chittaguta.
Chittaguta.
Chittaguta?
Chittaguta. Is that yours?
Yeah.
Say it again.
Chittaguta.
What's it mean, Rich?
One who has a guarded mind.
A guarded mind?
Chittaguta.
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 I like it. Sure, why not? Open the window. Let's be comfortable. So these currents of thought and belief, and maybe even guarded mind tendencies, come, at least in part, through the cultural, familial, community, religious activity. Doesn't even have to be words said, physical places with signs in front. There's a big church near my office where I see folks for therapy. When they built this church, big church, a lot of land, opened it up, multiple buildings, very lovely, high up, brand new. I like to ride my bike to work on the sidewalk, so I don't trust the drivers anymore on the road, so I get on the sidewalk to ride to work and be appropriate with the pedestrians. They have the right of way, I feel, on the sidewalk. Right? Okay. Maybe not for you, but for me it's that way. And I don't know whether it was a mistake or on purpose, but where the driveway, which is rather large, coming out of the church, crosses over the sidewalk to come out into the street, they put stop signs. And you know who they put the stop signs for? The pedestrians and the bicyclists. Now this got my foot out of my hose. And I'd ride by there thinking about this repeatedly. I'll get back to that. It deserves compassion. And I was like, if somebody doesn't change this and put the stop signs for the cars and give the pedestrians the right of way, I'm going to change it. And I started examining how these things were placed in the ground, not with concrete, thank goodness, that would have been difficult, into the dirt. And I started going through, like, I could get a screwdriver and I could do like that, I could do it up here, I could do it down there, I wonder what they'll think. And I would just, this was a chapter after chapter, I played this out. You know, and sometimes you pray. But you must be open to the fact that prayer isn't about getting what you want. Prayer is about generating the caring, open, unexpected energy that joins with the mystery of how things are, and maybe it happens close to the way you're praying for it. And you think your prayer got answered. There's a whole thing in there about prayer that's very deep. But we're going to have to tune into the nuns if we want to get that one. Anyways, it didn't move to the level of prayer with the stop signs. It moved right up to the place where I was ready to start to bring the tools in my backpack and operate on these stop signs. And then, mysteriously, somebody changed them and put them facing the cars. One more aside. Comes from the youthful times when I used to ride the bike in traffic and take chances and almost get killed a few times. There's a near-death experience where you almost get killed or you think you could have gotten killed, and then there's a near-death experience where you leave the body and come back. They're a little different. I got a little aggressive on my bike with some of these cars. I don't think you know this, but you're the one that should be stopping. Therefore, as I approach this area of intersection, I will be challenging you with my eyes. Just so you know, I'm not going to get hit. But I'm going to try to see if I can get you to stop. Now, I think all church-going people especially after church, but if they've got it going before church, should honor this. And no one hit me. And it only happened a couple times. The signs got changed, so I was out of that one. I've just learned recently that I don't have to do everything that I think I need to do. I used to think I had to do everything that came up. It was a weird one. Had a real kind of twisting, turning route to it at times. Got a little dangerous as well. Anyways, where's it coming from? Well, for many of us, there's a Judeo-Christian religious background. There's a Hindu background or a Hindu pickup. Feels right, looks good. Bhagavad Gita. Hare Krishna. Bring it in. Little pieces, little thoughts, little ideas, little practices. Here's a big one. Buddhist. Buddhist. Ideas. Theories. Concepts. Books. Teachers. Teachings. Residentials. A lot of ideation in there. A lot of streams of thought about this stuff. Another big one for some of us more than others, all the scientific influences, all the bodies of knowledge and research. Amazing, interesting, creative, insightful, intellectual, really refined intellectual analysis, intuitive realizations, scientific models. The mind picks up some of that, intrigued by it, interested in it, makes sense, fascinated, studies it, reads it. Believes in it. Metaphysical. New Age. Aquarian Age. The Crystal Age. Metaphysical ideas. Lifestyle ideas. Right way to live. Vegetarianism, veganism, fasting, exercise, yoga, tai chi, qigong, healing modalities, all those healing modalities, massage, acupuncture, homeopathy, herbology, and the mind, heart, body gets invested. This is right, this is good, this is, I like this, makes sense, I'm going to do it. You done a few of these things? Do you wonder why you think the way you think? Do you wonder where your thoughts are coming from? How about look to the influences? How about look to what's feeding the thinking? It's just interesting to begin to actually see it. And all this stuff is even more and more available. You just go, if you can put a word or two together, all you've got to do is Google it and watch it go and move and this and that. And it's just this boundless expression of life, creativity, past, history. I think Google's on this one. They're trying to get every book ever written on the net. I think that's one they're going for. And that's just one thing. We want to be very sensitive and careful about something right here, and that is this. In the early history of the birth of modern psychology, the so-called key point or keynote speaker was Sigmund Freud. A man who was very misunderstood by some, very understood by less, extremely helpful to some, probably addicted to drugs, and took himself out, as far as we know, with morphine. And yet his insights, the one I'm going to mention in particular, is extremely important. He had some insights into the unconscious. He had some insights into dreams. And he had some insights into why human beings suffer. And the one I want to share is simply this. He nailed, with simple direct language, what he called the repetition compulsion. This is his language. The repetition compulsion is this energy within the conditioned mind of the human being that compulsively repeats certain activities of thought, feeling, and behavior as if to change certain experiences, keywords, as if it believes it can change the experience through this particular repetitious activity. This is the root of habits. And we know, based on our own experience, there are certain habits that you say, this is a great habit, this is a wholesome habit. I eat mindfully. And I try to remember when I'm not. And I stop myself, and I slow down, and I eat more slowly. That's a good habit. Why would I want to get rid of that? You might be interested in not being limited to that, confined to that compulsion, subtle as it may be, to eat mindfully, when you're in a situation, like, for example, a wedding party, where it's noisy and loud and wild, perhaps, and your practice of mindfulness is extremely challenged because you're not sitting in the Franciscan Center suddenly anymore, with everybody silent around you, and Steve, probably not me, Steve is sitting there. Or one of these, you know, long-term sitters and eaters. And you realize when you watch their hand moving that mindfulness is really grace in motion. I thought that's what I could do at one point, and I was with this character, Bhante Gunaratana, this Sri Lankan monk in West Virginia. It was a low-key scene in those days. Basically, what he had was these kutis, which were like rough plywood shacks. And then he had a main house, and then had his space. It was really low-key. It was a long time ago. And some of you might know where I'm going, so I'll just get it out quick. I had this, like, I eat mindful, right, just really like this kind of thing. I'm really a robot. There's a point where you're, when you're invested in I am mindful, where you realize you're an utter stiff. You're a complete and utter robot. And you feel completely imprisoned. And all you want to do is, like, maybe punch somebody. Or just go out with this, like, containment. You know, and so I hadn't reached that point yet, but I come down from my kuti and my meditations in the pocket, and I'm grooving and I'm breathing and everything's smooth and forced, and you know, I'm on it. And these you know, for the Sri Lankan community in Washington, D.C., which was the big city near where Bhante lived, he's their priest. I mean, they revere this guy. And so it just so happens that for my lunch period, I'm going to come down and get, I thought, some, you know, greasy food by the cook who was cooking. It was clearly too greasy for my taste, but when you go to those places, you take what you can get. Well, that changed real fast. These Sri Lankans, like a multitude of them, countless Sri Lankans, came flying in cars with tons of platters of food and layers and people and kids, and they descended into my mindful meditation, silent meditation. And then Bhante sat back and was delighted by the fact that they'd arrived, and that he's up on the stage with a couple of the other monks, right? And I'm down below, right? I'm the only one down there. I'm out in the middle by myself, and then the Sri Lankans attacked. They moved in on me and started trying to, not literally force feed me, but food was coming from every angle. And the worst part about it was the nightmare, and it was a nightmare, of the deviled eggs. Hands were lifting the deviled eggs up towards my face like this. I was completely and utterly traumatized. Only because I was attached to being mindful, and I'm eating, and I don't want to be interrupted, and da 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 da. And I looked up, and this was the killer moment. I looked up, and Bhante was laughing his head off. The mind wanted to say, he's laughing his head off at me. He's completely and utterly entertained. But then, grace. He was laughing for me. And I started to cry. And I said, okay, I'll eat him. And then as soon as I could, I ran mindfully out of there, back to my kuti. I'm all right. You know, that's a mantra you can use when it gets real bad. I'm all right, I hope. So the repetition compulsion. It's deep in the unconscious, surfaces. I must do this or this. I must, that energy, I must do this or that. As if, so I can be released from having to do this or that. It's not the way Freud put it, but it's accurate. Good thing about these depths of insight, no matter who they come from, is that as they come through our own personal direct experience, we can find a further flowering and flavoring of that that's true and real for us in our moment in time. That's the gift of these insights as they come alive in your own experience. Nobody takes suffering more serious than the one who wants to awaken from it. And that one who wants to awaken from suffering is repetitiously compulsed to find a way. And you might say that that's the movement of compassion hiding inside the repetition compulsion, looking for a way out of the apparent prison theater of the mind. And yet, our contemplation, our meditation, our observation keeps revealing over and over and over, even as the repetition compulsion tendencies coming out, that it's this meditation, this contemplation, it isn't taking us anywhere other than, you might say, deeper and deeper into this. Deeper and deeper into what we sometimes call the here and now. The egoic mind, the conditioned mind, subtly or not so subtly, clings to teachers or teachings, believing that these teachers or teachings will reveal the way. Or, here's the opposite, the ego mind says, I'm not investing. I'll come to the retreat. I'm going to do my own thing. I know what I'm doing. I'm not going to attach to any teachings or teacher. No names for me. I'll keep my own. And come right into the hall. I can sit down and say, I'm not going to bond. That's dangerous. I'm not going to let this impulse of liking something or somebody overtake me. I'm going to sit back. In fact, I think I might even admit to myself, I'll hold back. This is brief, I hope. I have a very dear brother who I kind of love. I love him a lot, but he has brought interesting experiences to my life, and he threatens to come to one of these. He almost came to this one, but I told him that he had to sit still, which he understands because he's very Hare Krishna. He's got a few spiritual names too. He's got what, for me at least, is a lot of really crazy wisdom, and it's a little scary at times, I think, even to him. And he's my brother, one and only. And I think he cares about the same things that all of us care about in a unique way. But he likes to say things like, if I'm coming, you must know that I will teach for you. And if there's any reaction, he goes, you got some reaction there? You're reacting? What are you reacting for? You attached? This is just the game, right? So I said, well, you know, it has an element of non-duality in it. He goes, oh, really? So the non-dual. Oh. You know what you're doing there with that, do you? And I play back and I say, oh yeah, absolutely, we're beyond the non-dual, you can't come, you won't get it, man, you won't get it, even if I let you not sit still, even if you can do whatever you want. So I gotta watch this, because he might say to me at the end of this retreat, did you talk about me? See, because there was a period of time, I love him for this one particularly, when he did come around. And a strange thing happened. People started relating to him in the following words. Oh, you're Paul Lynn's brother. Oh, you're Paul Lynn's brother. Oh, you're Paul Lynn's brother. And finally he said to me, is that the name I got at birth? Paul Lynn's brother? See, all the while in there, there's this opportunity. It's really cool. And we both know it in our own way. He's saying, and I'm saying, who are you? Who are you? Who are you really? That's why he's my spiritual friend. I'm just glad the motorcycle years are over. So this egoic mind, strangely enough, clings to teachings and teachers like a drowning man clinging to a log. It's a strong word to use here, drowning. We either drowned in samsara, we drowned in the repetition compulsion, we drowned in it, or we see through it. It's a strong word too, but a good one. This is really a fundamental act of faith and compassion. It's not about the will and the controlling tendency that seems to be born from it, that allows release of the tiller, which some people call surrender. I like to just call it clear seeing how life is really working, because when how life is really working is seen clearly, there's no issue about surrendering. You don't need to surrender because you know, or you see, or it's clear, there's nobody holding the tiller. There never was. It simply was a dream. That life's got you covered, life's in charge, the Dharma is the law of the way things are. And even just for a second, and we can't regulate this second, it appears spontaneously out of the ripeness and sincerity, you might say, of our caring. And even that is hard to say that that is causing it or contributing to it. But we like to think that's true. We like to think that sitting here in this hall is more likely to help generate insight than going to McDonald's across the river. But we wouldn't dare tell that to the people in the McDonald's across the river, would we? But we might think it. Now, isn't that kind of arrogant? Isn't that kind of spiritual and materialistic? Isn't that kind of entitled? This seeing clearly that I'm pointing at, this possibility of seeing clearly, is so important and so truly reliable. Because it pauses or even fully stops the repetition compulsion, the seeking mind. Maybe just for a few seconds, maybe longer. In either case, a veil, maya, in the Hindu tradition it's called, maya is being pierced. And as that piercing happens, a little or a lot, what appears? Life is always happening exactly the way it's happening. Such a simple sentence. Such an obvious thing, in a way, makes complete, rational, cognitive sense, and yet when it hits the experiential level, when it's realized that what is happening cannot be any way other than the way it is, any way other than its instant of appearance, and then, if that isn't magical enough, If that isn't mysterious enough for you, it changes spontaneously right before your eyes. It's there and then it's not. It's this and then it's that. When life is really seen clearly, when living, let me use that word instead, when living is really seen clearly, it instantaneously transforms. Which is another way to say it instantaneously disappears. Everything is becoming something other than it was the instant before. That's why nothing actually exists. Because existence connotes duration in time, correct? Everything is constantly changing in its content, and yet its underlying true nature, its underlying reality, is that it's unchanging in that it is exactly as it is in the instant it appears. Everything appears exactly as it appears, and then it disappears. This is right in science now. The quark, is it called? The quark, they're saying, is and isn't at the same time. That's the smallest thing, supposedly, that we've gotten down to. It's seen life that doesn't change inside that which is changing. And you are both that changing process and that which doesn't change simultaneously. This is huge in a way, because it releases the mind, even for just a moment, from notions of betterment, notions of improvement. And on the underside, it frees the mind from what we sometimes believe to be the opposite of betterment, which is everything we consider to be worse. All of a sudden, that's neutralized. No better, no worse. Rilke said it like this, the poet Rilke, "Don't be confused by the surface. In the depths of everything, there is the law." And this is the Dharma now, the law. Not the laws that humans have made to keep us from misbehaving too much, hopefully. Because we're wild, crazy creatures. And we can harm ourselves and others if we don't have some structure and guidelines. We can get out of hand with our behavior and our language. And the forces of greed, hatred, and delusion can rise up like snakes and grab the mind and behavior. Next thing you know, it's being acted out. That's one of the places where compassion arises, as that's seen more and more deeply. The helpless insanity of the repetition compulsion of greed, hatred, and delusion. How can one not be touched and experience compassion in relation to that, once even a glimpse outside the theater has arisen? This natural truth, yeah, that you are the surface and the depth simultaneously, this natural truth, that is what is happening exactly the way it's happening, and constantly changing, is utterly and completely impersonal. And that's not a negative use of the word impersonal. It means common to all. And intimately, if you will, intimately personal, in that it covers everything that you would call you. There is nothing that appears other. There is no other in what's being pointed at here. And this is why realization is never about more. It is always about less, always about simplification, particularly when it comes to the apparent needs for acquisition.